Hello, I'm Bill Hancock, founder and CEO of FaithBridge Foster Care. We've produced these podcasts for you, and we hope that you'll enjoy them. We designed them to be informational, inspirational, and we hope directional for you and your family as you continue the journey of Christian foster care ministry. Let's shift and talk. Let's talk about reporting, mandatory reporting. You just mentioned schools. A lot of reports of child abuse, abandonment, neglect come in through schools. What are some of the other ways that reporting comes in? And who is mandated by law to report child abuse? And maybe talk a little bit about who and what is child abuse? How do we know when we see child abuse? And who's reported? Who's mandatorily by law required to report?
Child abuse, I'm sure there's a legal definition somewhere, but most people, when they hear of child abuse, they think of either physical abuse or sexual abuse. Those are the two things that pop into your head. And folks will see bruising, we'll see wounds, that sort of thing. And then there's some very almost textbook typical behavior that comes with a child who is sexually abused. A trained social worker can spot them a mile off. Unfortunately, we're not all trained social workers, are
right,
we?
Right.
But right now in Georgia, those that are mandated to report are teachers, nurses, doctors. I would think the clergy, with some exceptions, have those mandates to report. Probably it would probably even go down to coaches, things of that nature. People that would have a lot of contact.
People that connect professionally or routinely with children.
I have always felt as an officer of the court that I am a mandated reporter. I think that when people realize and shift their focus just a little bit away from the "I don't want to get involved" to "I'm supposed to get involved because that's what Christ told us to do."
And
you're not, you know, nobody likes to be the tattletale, but you're not real. People need to remember that you could be saving a child's life. Legislation pending in the Georgia legislature right now. We spoke about that a moment ago. It could very well be that it crossed over yesterday as we speak. And it was in direct response to the child abuse scandal at Penn State University. Because everybody's pointing fingers at everybody else up there as to who was supposed to tell. Well, how long did they point those fingers? And if they had... If somebody had spoken up years ago, how many children would have been saved or prevented from suffering the abuse, the alleged abuse that has happened or has been alleged to happen? So mandatory reporting is something that we really need to train our conscience about. And I dare say that if you are a parent, a church-going average kind of person, Jane and Joe that I would meet at my local church, my home church, I dare say that you're equipped to figure out if there's child abuse. Because if something just doesn't seem right, it probably isn't. And I think we need to shift our focus from not wanting to get involved again to understanding that you may be the only person that could protect that child.
So if you think there's a problem, act, be proactive, and report. And let's talk about reporting. Who do you call?
You call your local Department of Family and Children Services.
So you call your local DFACS office, and those numbers, you get those numbers, they're published all over the place. They're easy to find. But you just call. What should someone expect if you report a child abuse? What should you expect?
Well, it can
What's the rules?
It can be done anonymously.
Okay.
So nobody's going to come point the finger and say, "Hey, you ratted me out."
So you don't have to leave your address, your phone number, your email address, or anything.
No, you don't.
Okay.
And the satisfaction of knowing that you've done something. Hey, if they go out and investigate and there's no problem, who's been harmed?
Yeah.
who's been harmed. Mm-hmm. But if they go out and investigate and there is a problem, then who's been saved?
Mm, good point, Judy. That's great. That's well said. Well said. Let's talk about if a report is made, child comes into care. Talk to people who maybe are thinking about, I'd like to better understand what it means to be a foster parent, what it would be like to have a child come into my home. What happens when a child comes into, say, that report and there's an investigation and there is evidence of abuse? What happens at that point?
Well, at that point, then the child is taken into custody mm-hmm. by the caseworker on call. Those calls never come when it's convenient during office hours. I have spoken to many of the DFACS caseworker who's said, oh, it's 5 o'clock on Friday. My phone's bound to ring any minute. And sure enough, they get a call. And it really depends on the age of the child, because folks don't think about, maybe some folks have this stereotypical idea that you've got a 5-year-old child or a 4-year-old child or something like that. You might have a few days old infant.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes if a child is born and the nurses and the doctors at the hospital realize that the family of origin, that the biological parents are incapable of mm-hmm. caring for that child, especially if there's medical needs.
Right.
Special needs and right. For that child. And they see through observation that, hey, this mom doesn't have a clue about how to mm-hmm. mix up the formula or mm-hmm. how to do a feeding tube or mm-hmm. that sort of mm-hmm. thing, or the child's got to have special oxygen or, you know, mm-hmm. that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. They will make the report.
Okay.
And a child can come into care that way.
Okay.
A child can come into care up to the age of 17, let's
okay.
face it.
Okay.
Every child is different, but what happens if we want to make a blanket talk about that?
Just an idea of what happens. Sure. They have evidence. What does a caseworker do at that moment?
Well, they call the foster family who they think that might be the best fit,
mm-hmm.
and wonderful news if it's in an area that's served by Faithbridge, they can call a Faithbridge consultant. And that Faithbridge consultant has got, it seems to be an encyclopedic idea, memory of who they've got in the hopper, so to speak, and who they can call and who would be a good fit.
Mm-hmm.
Because sometimes it's finding a bed for the night.
Mm-hmm.
That's all they need. They need a bed for the night. Mm-hmm. They need a safe, warm bed, mm-hmm. you know, a meal right. and a bed. That's all they need. Sometimes these kids are taken into care and you don't know how long it's going to be.
Uh-huh.
So you don't want to move them from home to home to home. One of the tragedies that is endemic in the foster care system is that many of these children, if they've been in care longer than 2 years, 3 years, they can start counting on their fingers the different placements they've had.
Yeah.
I'm in the middle of doing an adoption right now, that the child is older and was able to tell me the different placements, including group homes and things of that nature, mm. and ran out of fingers on their two hands. And stability is so key
mm-hmm.
for a child.
Mm-hmm.
Think how you would feel if you woke up every 3 weeks in a different place and had different rules to follow and a different... we eat cereal. Well, no, this house eats eggs and bacon. Well, this family goes to the drive-thru at McDonald's, but this family has Pop-Tarts.
Very disruptive. It's kind of hard to be a kid when nothing seems to be constant.
They can't be a kid, and that's the key. But what happens when the child is taken into care? I keep chasing rabbits, Bill.
Yeah,
I'm sorry.
It's okay. At least they're fat rabbits.
They're fat rabbits. That's right. The child's taken into care, and by law, within 72 hours, a hearing has to be held in juvenile court to determine whether or not there is probable cause for deprivation,
okay.
that sort of thing. I have seen 72-hour hearings be held within 72 hours. I've seen 72-hour hearings been held weeks, even months later.
But it's required that when a child is taken into custody,
yes.
taken to a foster home, within 72 hours, there's supposed to be a court hearing.
Exactly.
And what's that court hearing for?
Well, it's to determine whether or not there is neglect or abuse or deprivation.
And if there's not, at that 72 hours, the court looks at that and says, well, this is not a real deprivation or abuse case. Child goes back home, or what happens?
I would hesitate to say that the child would immediately go back home, because the caseworker has usually had pretty good instincts about it. When they go to a home and it is filthy beyond belief, there's drug paraphernalia laying out, there's evidence of, you know, they open the refrigerator, there's no food. They open the cupboard, there's no food. There's evidence of rat infestation or roach infestation, that kind of thing.
Right. So if we get to a 72-hour hearing, there's a pretty good chance that child is going to be in care.
Pretty good chance.
So they're going to be in a foster home, pretty good chance, for a while. After 72 hours, then what happens? We've had a court case. Now what?
Well, let the games begin.
Now?
Because you got a mom and probably a dad, maybe a dad, that come to the hearing, and they each fill out an application for a attorney to be appointed for them, because they are indigent, unable to afford that attorney. If they are married and their interests are not opposed to each other's interests, then they can use the same attorney. Oftentimes, the judge will go ahead and appoint an attorney for each of them, because oftentimes what happens is their roads separate and split, and their interests become opposite to each other. So they obviously the attorney that can't represent one or both if their interests are different, if their desires are different or whatnot. So you've got the attorney for the department, you've got the attorney for the mom, you've got the attorney for dad. At that point, then, a lot of times, the judge will appoint a guardian ad litem to be the attorney for the children. And then in some wonderful counties, most wonderful counties, a CASA worker, a court-appointed special advocate, will be appointed for the child as
That's
well.
That's a CASA worker.
A CASA worker is a court-appointed special advocate. And they are not attorneys. They are ordinary folks who have had it laid upon their heart that they need to do something for children. And they are wonderful people that actually have the chance to invest in the children. They don't have the caseload that a caseworker or even a FaithBridge consultant would have. They make it a point to go and visit the children, to talk with the children, earn their trust. They take little gifts to the children, that sort of thing, play with the kids.
So they're a real advocate. They really are an advocate in the court. They get to know the kids, and they get to go into court and talk on behalf of the children.
And I have seen the whole court proceeding stop when the judge listens very carefully, very closely to what the CASA has to say. Because this person does not have a dog in the fight.
They don't
have a loyalty to the department. They don't have a loyalty to their client. They don't have a loyalty to the judicial system. They're one goal and aim is to make sure that that child is, their best interest is represented and told. It's a wonderful thing, and judges take very seriously.
Yeah, they have a lot of they have a lot of influence.
Absolutely,
on the judge's decision. So they come in a 72-hour court hearing. The birth parents or parent is now going to be required to get legal representation through the court, because this is now going to be a court case. It's going to have to meet the standards for a judge to make the decision if this child goes back home.
Exactly. And what will happen then is that the department will work with sit down with the mom or the dad, or mom and dad, hopefully. But who are we kidding? We often see these single parent households.
Yeah, and they're oftentimes a mom.
Oftentimes,
unfortunately. Raising more than one
child. So they prepare what's called a case plan. And it's very important for your folks to understand what is on a typical case plan. Many times it will say that the person, the individual, the mom is required to obtain and maintain stable housing. Obtain and maintain employment. Get utilities in their own name. Apply for food stamps or other benefits and that sort of thing. And there's not a thing wrong with people being on public assistance, mm-hmm. when it's a hand up, mm-hmm. you know, what's the saying? Not a handout, but a help up. That's that kind right. of thing. Yeah. And then to either finish their GED or something like that, and to learn how to parent. And your people are going to think, huh? What do you mean get a house or an apartment?
Right.
What they don't realize is that this is a generational, many times a generational epidemic. You've got folks... And that's why I'm so excited about your birth parent mentor program.
Isn't that exciting?
Oh, man, we could talk a whole other day
I
about
know.
That.
We'll have a whole other session on just birth parent, approaching birth parents, how to really minister to them, and what are some of the barriers for their success. But we're going to have to come back on that.
Okay.
I want you
okay.
to go on with what
All
you're
right.
saying there.
So you've got folks that have never in their life lived at any place more than 12 months at
yeah,
the most at
yeah.
any one place.
Yeah, it's become a lifestyle.
Exactly.
Yeah.
You start looking at the kids' school records and you find out that in 3 years they've changed schools 9 times.
Mm-hmm.
How can there be
mm-hmm.
any educational mm-hmm. continuity? Well, of course there can't be.
Right.
Then you see what they're supposed to obtain transportation.
Mm-hmm.
Well, in the metro area, you do have public transportation you can rely on.
Right.
But out in the boonies where I live, There is no public transportation.
So job, housing, transportation, health care, food, utilities in your name. You've got to be able to provide a home for your children that is safe, that is stable. You've got to feed them.
Mm-hmm.
And when those elements of a case plan, that is the minimum requirement.
That's the bare minimum requirement, and typically what's thrown in there is to have clean drug screens.
Clean drug screens. And because oftentimes drugs mm-hmm. is a part of the mm-hmm. Failure for a mother and a family to thrive.
Exactly.
It?
And then if there's a problem with family violence,
right.
It will be written into the case plan too that the mom discontinue contact with the boyfriend or the husband
okay.
or the
right.
significant other
right.
who has rendered family violence
right.
in the family.
Right.
So sadly, I see many women who turn away from their children to choose the boyfriend or the
even when he's violent.
Yes.
Mm.
But it goes back to the generational issue.
Mm-hmm.
You oftentimes you'll have I've talked to many young moms. Well, you know, if I didn't deserve it, he wouldn't beat me, and they're very sincere.
Mm.
But what I'm trying to get across to your folks, to your foster parents, is that what we take for granted, housing, employment, transportation, food, what we would call the bare necessities, is a very high bar for these folks to meet.
Mm-hmm.
A very high bar for these
mm-hmm.
folks to meet. And they do the best they can. When I first started doing this a long time ago, the department had money
mm-hmm.
to provide services to the parents, to the birth
mm-hmm.
parents, to
mm-hmm.
the family of origin. They would mm-hmm. give them homestead, the parent aides. People would actually come in and show them how to clean their kitchen, how to clean their bathroom. And you and I are sitting here thinking, well, what's the big deal? You just get some Clorox wipes and a vacuum cleaner and have at it. They don't get it. They don't know. They've never been taught. It's
mm-hmm.
never been modeled for
mm-hmm.
them.
Mm-hmm.
You've got kids coming into foster care
mm-hmm.
who think that a square meal is a hot dog, chips, and a Diet Coke.
Mm-hmm.
To them, that's living large.
Yeah. Yeah.
So they would have people come in too and teach them how to prepare a nutritious meal.
Mm-hmm.
But all that money's gone. There's no support to do any of that anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And that gets me back to the mentors for the biological parents, the
yeah.
birth. Because even if these children don't go back to that home,
mm-hmm.
the likelihood is very high that these biological parents are going to have more children.
Yeah, that's true. Even if the children do not go home, and let me talk to you for a moment about, we'll come back and talk about if they don't go home. Let's talk about when they do go home first. you just described very, very eloquently and very detailed about what is required for a mother, oftentimes a single, working a case plan that has been designed by the court, and she's expected to meet all those goals and standards, and that's a very high bar for her. And we know that children can stay 6 months to a year while that mother's working on that case plan, trying to get all those elements in place. And say, for example, she gets it all in place, she passes the drug screen, she moves out the violent boyfriend, and the judge says, okay, the kids are going home. What happens when the court decides everything's okay for the child to go home? Who's there now?
Oftentimes, nobody.
Nobody.
And that's the scary thing. Yeah. Now, one of the requirements that's standard in case plans is that there be visitation. And that's one of the hurdles that the
after
case, no before they go home.
Okay, before the judge says they go home. Exactly. While they're still in the foster home,
right?
They're having visitation. Mm-hmm. Okay,
and that's what's very important for your foster parents to observe, because if little Johnny goes to a visit with his mom, mm-hmm. and when he comes back, if he's hoarding his food, or if he's very violent toward everybody, or if he's withdrawn or sullen or things of that nature, they need to report that to their consultant.
Yes.
They need to let folks know of the adverse effect of the visitation on the child. Uh-huh. But if mom has done everything she's supposed to do, mm-hmm. and let's pray that she does, mm-hmm. Because that is the goal.
It is.
Is to reunite these families, mm-hmm. and to equip them, mm-hmm. to be better families.
Right.
Because we don't want to send the child back to where he came from.
Now, and at Faith Bridge, it's a real opportunity for us as a Christian mission and ministry, and as foster families fulfill the call to be with Christ in his mission in the lives of restoring people who are hurting, people who are lonely, people who feel, like you said, this is their lifestyle. Mm-hmm. They're just used to living without jobs, and sometimes moving place to place and taking their children every time they move. So that's kind of the routine. What we really hope is that they're able to see that God has a place and a plan for their life. And that place is among other believers, where they can be nurtured, supported, and they can do life with other people and not have to do it alone anymore.
Absolutely.
And that's part of when you talk about the visitation. That is such an important part of the ministry outreach for a Faith Bridge family.
Oh, absolutely.
Mm-hmm. We don't just see that visitation. You know, when you're watching, yes, you need to pay close attention to the children, because you need to see if they're having adverse impact, mm-hmm. and if you do need to report that. Because either way it goes, and we pray, like you just said, that families are going to be reunified. And we pray that that mother may find a new life and a new heart and get a new start with a new heart and a new way of living and looking at the world and her place in it. But there are times where that doesn't work out and the child doesn't go home. And it's determined that the child will live with someone else other than that parent, and that's the court takes the authority to terminate a person's rights to parent. We call that termination of parental rights.
Right.
And when that termination takes place, we've done all we can. Part of that visitation and trying to work to renew that family allows the foster parent, foster family consultant, other advocates and volunteers and part of the community of care to be able to say clearly, we've tried, we've done what we can do to help. It's now time for the child to have a permanent family.
Absolutely. And what happens even legally before the court moves to terminate parental rights, the attorney for the department actually files a petition for non-reunification.
Okay.
And up to this point, the goal everybody has been fixed on, all full speed ahead, let's reunite this family.
Yes, get these kids home.
Absolutely. Everything we can do, let's reunite this family. But at that point, then, if the judge grants the petition for non-reunification and orders that what he does actually, what he or she does is actually rule that no, the department need make no further efforts.
Okay.
And that includes visitation.
Right, so they can stop the visitations?
They sure can. Mm-hmm.
Okay. The intent now is termination of parental rights.
And that's what they're moving towards.
Moving towards finding this child a permanent family.
Exactly. And the termination of parental rights is a very, it's a very serious matter. It's been likened by the Georgia Supreme Court very aptly, I thought, as a death sentence. Because it actually reduces the parent, the family of origin, to be as if they were dead.
As if they never existed.
Exactly, exactly. Mm-hmm. So what happens then is if the department, the attorney for the department files the petition for termination of parental rights, there's a trial, a full-fledged trial. Of course, it's not in front of a jury. And foster families need to know that they are encouraged to attend these court proceedings. Mm-hmm. And they need to let the judge know that they're there. Mm-hmm. Oftentimes, they won't be called as a witness. I mean, don't be in fear that you're going to be called as a witness or anything. But sometimes the judge will say, I recognize Mrs. Jones is in the courtroom, and I would like to ask her a few questions, or would you mind speaking to us about how little Johnny's doing?
Yeah.
So that would be a chance for you, too, to speak up
right
on behalf of the ones that have no voice, that can't speak for themselves. The children, they never go to court themselves. But anyway, that the termination of parental rights, the regular trial and hearing is held, and then if the judge rules and orders that the rights of the parents be terminated, then they will typically set a date out in the future, perhaps 6 months or so, for an adoption efforts review. The last thing that the judge wants is for this child to become a permanent ward of the state.
Right. They want them to have a permanent family through adoption or legal guardianship or what are the
other permanent options? A permanent guardianship even. And it could be that they determine that it's not appropriate to terminate the rights of the parent, but that they will give to someone, a caregiver, typically a relative, permanent guardianship. And when permanent guardianship is granted, that means that the judge has actually considered all the facts and said, you know, in this case, termination of parental rights is not appropriate, but this child will never go back to that family of origin. That happens a lot when a child's older.
Okay.
And they're ready to soon going to age out of the system
right.
Anyway.
May not be easily adopted.
Exactly, exactly. Unfortunately, sometimes you've got folks that don't understand what a permanent guardianship means, and I've had folks call me and that they have talked a family member into giving them permanent guardianship, and I'm like, oh, please tell me the judge didn't grant it, and they have. And by that finding, in my opinion, it would be very difficult to then go back and persuade that same judge, oh, it is appropriate to terminate parental rights. Let's have an adoption here. Mm-hmm. But that's a discussion again for another day.
Yes.
And that kind of thing.
I'm making notes on several other follow-up discussions here today. Tell me what we get down to this termination and a foster parent decides they want to adopt.
Mm-hmm. That's a good thing.
It's a great thing. It happens... It happens often at Faithbridge when a child becomes available for adoption. We've seen over the last 36 months, we've seen over 50 children adopted.
I'm not surprised the number's that high. The thing that you need to caution your folks about, though, is that don't go into this and sign up with Faithbridge or whatnot and get involved if all you are looking to do is adopt.
You're right. You're very right.
Because that may not be the case. Your role, what God has gifted you with, is the ability to parent that child, be it for a night, a weekend, 2 weeks, 6 months, a year, the rest of their lives.
Yes. Yeah.
But when the child comes into care, nobody really knows.
We really don't.
I have seen kids that I thought would surely go back to their biological parents who end up getting their rights terminated, or the mom surrenders.
Yeah.
It could very well be that you know, 6 months down the line or 9 months down the line, the mom just comes to the caseworker and says, I can't do this.
Yes.
What are my options?
Right.
And then at that point, they will allow the mom to surrender her rights to the child.
Yes.
And then, of course, that makes the child free for adoption
right.
as well. But even if you only have that child 2 weeks, that's 2 weeks of stability, 2 weeks of a family that eats a meal together, that prays
together, they
that
experience
reads the Bible,
the presence of God.
Absolutely.
They truly brush up against Christ.
And we are Jesus' feet and hands, and we need never forget that. And if you've got a child for a season, you may have a child for a season that they hear the story of Jesus for the first time. And think of the ramifications, the lifetime of ramifications. What if that child accepts Christ in your home and then goes back to their family of origin?
You know, I have a friend of mine who grew up in foster care. He's now in his 50s, and he's a great family. And he was telling me when he went into Fulton County, Atlanta, foster care system at 11, he had been in, as you mentioned earlier, he'd moved around a lot, had numerous foster families. But when he finally came to a Christian family, he said as soon as he walked in that home, he knew it was different.
Thank you for your compassionate service to foster children. FaithBridge is here to serve you. If we can support you in any way, please contact our team. It is our desire to help you succeed in all that God has called you and your family to be, to children who desperately need you.